My name is Bill Grace, and I work at the Center for Ethical Leadership in Seattle. And this evening's session is entitled, If God Was an Economist. And I'd like to spend about the first 30 minutes presenting some ideas and then have a robust conversation around that. But this evening, I'd like to add something additional. I'd like to reserve about 5 minutes at the end for us to reflect on the question, based on this information in our discussion, is there something that we each could do back home in our home communities to make whatever sort of sticks with you as a result of this conversation have legs in your home community? And I ask you to think about it. We'll talk more about this sort of as maybe part of the evening offering as we think about heading to Vespers. Is there something you'll do, in this case, giving your talents to some work at home in relation to the economy? Okay, I'd like to begin by using the overhead again and sharing some concepts. Let me know if it's in focus. The first concept is from a book entitled For the Common Good, very helpful book on the economy, I think, written from a faith perspective. I can't remember, Daly and Cobb are the authors. It may be in the bookstore. I've not looked for it, to be honest. But let me just introduce us, as the authors do, to two important concepts around the economy. This is sort of an ancient debate about 3,000 years old, and crematistics is a branch of the political economy relating to the manipulation of property and wealth to maximize short-term monetary exchange of value to the owner. Oikonomia, which is where we actually get the word economy, you can probably hear it in there, oikonomia, is the management, and I'd like you to pick up this word, the management of the household so as to increase its value to all members of the household over the long run. And just in the back of your mind, take a look at the American economy and for yourselves, for the moment, try to determine which model you think we might be living under more fully. Let's take a little bit of a history tour before going on to the next slide. And I'd like to just talk for a couple minutes about a person named Adam Smith. Who is Adam Smith?
He wrote about the invisible hand and the mind economy.
Okay. Adam Smith was a Scottish pastor, okay, who was very intrigued by the work of Sir Isaac Newton. Sir Isaac Newton had taken a world that must have been very scary to live in, a world that was probably most accurately described before his time by things like magic and accident. And Newton entered into that world and helped to devise a series of natural laws that began to explain the natural world. And Adam Smith was very taken by Newton. He was very intrigued by the simplistic models that Newton created to explain very complex interactions. And in some ways, Adam Smith probably aspired to be Newton, to be like Newton in the social world. This is what Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations, a longer title than that, but it's essentially the paradigm upon which the modern marketplace in market economies is still based on. And here were some of his notions. He believed that these were laws. Okay, it's important to note that what is this law called?
Gravity.
Gravity. He believed that that's a difficult law to violate. I tried it several times today on the hike to Holden Lake, and that is a fairly unforgiving law. Adam Smith thought that he could describe laws that would work equally predictably, equally powerful in the social realm. His goal was to try to create the good society and to bring questions of faith into our economic lives together. That was the goal of his work. Here was some of his assumptions. First of all, he believed that there was a three-legged stool. And if the market economy was to work, all three legs needed to be equally strong and like sturdy stools that you've sat on, about the same length, meaning we'd give them the same amount of attention. This is what he felt that the market economy would be balanced upon: the creation of wealth, the creation of goodness, and the creation of justice. Those were the three legs of the market economy. Someone mentioned the hidden hand. That's a very important concept. Now, this is a spiritual person thinking. Here's what he believed: that anytime you set out to create wealth, you would automatically create goodness. It would operate like the laws of physics. If you created wealth, you created goodness. Question for us today is, can we think of any examples in the modern era where wealth has been created without goodness? That's an important question. I mean, leverage buyouts and corporate takeovers are the boldest examples of creating wealth without creating goodness, but there's hundreds of them, and it's important to reflect on that in our own lives, how we spend our money, but also in the lives of the corporate and government sector in particular. Here's what he believed: that even if an entrepreneur, totally motivated by self-interest, were to create wealth privately, independently, even selfishly, the hidden hand would operate and would ensure that goodness would be created. My sense is that what he probably meant was, in some ways, the spirit. Later, as people began to consider that the hidden hand was not operating, some people believed that that was the role of government, that if the entrepreneur could not maintain that sense of balance themselves, then government had a moral responsibility to create structures that would ensure that the creation of wealth would result in the creation of goodness. Even though we have critiqued Newton's laws over the last 250 to 300 years, because Newton's law explains life sort of on this plane that we live our life for the most part, as we all know, it really does not explain life at the submolecular level. We needed a number of different theories, including relativity, to begin to explain complexities of life beyond that which is apparent. And we have freely, and scientists have freely engaged in a critique of Newton's concepts. They have seen it as part of the role of being a scientist. And in that same period of time, about 250 to 300 years, we have very rarely critiqued the economic paradigm upon which our market economy is based. That's important to know. Remember that, so that was just a little bit of history. If you remember these two schools, maybe it's clear to all of us that the one that we live under most fully is crematistics. And the question of, if God was an economist, what would God recommend for the goodness of our lives together? And so I'd like to explore economia a little bit more. This image here is the people standing in circles creating the Olympic flag. And it's sort of something that jumped out at me as maybe an important symbol of the sort of global community that we're capable of conceptualizing. And management of the household, as you read that, it's important for you to think about, what do you think of when you think of household? Is it your household? Is it your church, your neighborhood? Is it your city? Is it your state? Is it the world? And if God were an economist, what would God mean by household? The management of the household so as to increase the value to all members of the household. Smith felt that that was economics. The management of the household to increase value to all members of the household. What is stewardship? somebody want to take a stab at that? What is stewardship? Anyone?
Care.
Caring.
Mm-hmm.
Sure is. What else?
Management. Recognition that God is the owner and you are just the manager.
Okay, recognition that God is the owner and you're just the manager. Let's take a look at this. Stewardship. Stewardship, an original definition, is the management, notice the word again, of the household in the owner's absence. Who's the owner?
God.
As stewards, we have been asked to manage the created order in God's absence. It's not that God is really absent, but that God apparently is patient enough to operate through our choices. Just one last word, because not only do we live in a market economy, we live in a democracy. And take a look at the definition for the word citizen. This goes back to Aristotle. Aristotle thought that a citizen, it's where we get the word city, too, okay? It's actually from the Latin civitas, and the Greeks used the word polis, and it's where we get politics. But to be a citizen was to be a member of a household. What word keeps creeping up here?
Household.
Household. The household of God. Question again we need to ask in our own hearts is how big is that in our own lives? Okay. While this is up here, and by the way, I'm going to do a brief commercial on a book at the bookstore. I didn't get to the bookstore today to know if there's any left, but this book by Robert Greenleaf entitled Servant Leadership, I think really addresses some of these issues. This, by the way, is not available in the Village, I don't think, is a study on economic life from the Division for Church and Society in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, a relatively new publication. Give us this day our daily bread, sufficient, sustainable livelihood for all. One of the things you might consider is ordering this and having some discussions at your church around this sometime this fall. But I would like to take a look at the concept of stewardship again by leaning on a book that Duane has brought to our attention, Manna and Mercy. This is in the bookstore. Dan Erlander is the author, and he talks about Sabbath. The Sabbath day, the Sabbath year, and the Jubilee year. And I believe that these definitions really pose an ethical dilemma. What is most important in our lives, community or property? Crematistics, if you go back to that, suggests that property is more important than community. And stewardship and oikonomia, I believe, suggests that community is more important than property. Now this, what I'm about to read, are teachings that come out of the Mosaic community, the people wandering in the wilderness, having found their freedom from slavery in Egypt. And here's what Erlander says about these three important concepts. On Sabbath days, the partner people, as he calls them, will rest. What a gift of grace. God lets the people know the world will not fall apart if you do not work all the time. It doesn't even fall apart when God takes a day off. Now, Sabbath year, the Sabbath day is the seventh day. The Sabbath year is the seventh year. Consider what the community of believers in Moses' time enacted as laws. And we can look to Exodus and to Deuteronomy to find the specific citations. But this is the community that Moses was building in the wilderness, and that's an important note as well. On Sabbath years, the seventh year, many joyful things will happen. The people and the land will rest for the year. Remember rotating crops and all that stuff, which we do now? That was that we allow the land to lie fallow. This is happening. This is being managed back in the time of Moses. Work animals will enjoy rest and refreshment. There will be abundant food for all. All, listen to this, all debts will be canceled. One way to keep Pharaoh's Egypt from happening. All slaves will go free with help to start again. Now, the Jubilee year, or the Grand Sabbath, is the seventh year, and that's either 49 years or 50, depending on how you count. And here's Jubilee years. On Jubilee years, all land lost because of debt or misfortune will go back to the original inheritor. God's way of assuring that this society will never become like Pharaoh's Egypt, with rich and poor land hoarders and landless slave workers, by keeping the Jubilee, this people will live as God's contrast society. Coming out of slavery, the people of Israel begin to create laws, begin to create systems of governing themselves that will allow them to preserve, I believe, community as a higher order value than property. And consider in your own community whether or not property is of greater or lesser value than community. When I see gated communities, that becomes obvious to me that a choice has been made that, in that case, property is more important than community. As a matter of fact, we wall off certain portions of the community in order to protect things. Okay? So now I'd like to just rifle through a few concepts around the integration of faith and the economy and leadership, and then open it up for discussion. And this is to pursue some logic along the way, I hope. I think we all might agree that the world is a gift from God to all humanity. With that as an assumption, then we begin to take a look at economia and stewardship and being a contrast society. And if that's true then, and if this is true, if politics and economic events are spiritual affairs, that it's not something that we do outside of our faith, but could it be that our faith calls us to be concerned about political and economic events that would affect the Sabbath, that would affect the creation of a contrast society, that would affect our ability to care for all members of the household? We have to decide this in our own hearts. If our goal as stewards is to manage the household in the owner's absence, then could it be that political and economic events are spiritual? Now, we're going to get into this more tomorrow. Because power corrupts, prophetic confrontation and critique are necessary. It means that as humans, we're likely to fall off the wagon, especially if you've got a lot of resources or a lot of power. The temptation, as we talked about earlier yesterday, is to hang on to that power, to try to turn to hang on to those gifts, and to try to turn it into a means of accruing personal power, thus the seeds of injustice are sown. Knowing that this is probably a human condition, then what is the role of prophetic critique? And we've been looking at the prophets all week in Bible study and have a better sense now of what prophetic critique means. And if this is true, if passivity equals compliance, and here's what I mean by that. If bad things are happening and I do nothing, what does that make me? If bad things are happening and I do nothing, could it be that it makes me an accomplice? So, what are our ethical and covenantal responsibilities to God as stewards? I believe it was Micah today. I missed the Bible study because I was speaking. But did you talk about Micah today?
Yes.
Then you probably recognize this as Micah 6:8. What are our ethical and covenantal responsibilities to God? To do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with our God.
So what I'd like to do is to go back to the first slide and suggest that this is the tension that we live in, that the dominant materialistic model in our culture is probably the one on your left, crematistics. Notice the components. The manipulation of property and wealth to maximize short-term exchange of value to the owner. That is a landlord-oriented model of economics. The contrast, oikonomia, the management of the household so as to increase its value to all members of the household over the long run. And that is a community-oriented understanding of the economy. And the question is, what does our faith call us to? And if God were an economist, what does that mean for our lives as children of God who have political and economic responsibility as stewards? It's about 6:44. I'd like to end at 7:20 and to preserve about 5 minutes for us to answer the question, what is one thing that you'll do in your home community as a result of this discussion? So let's open it up there, and I'm just going to leave the projector on in case people want to reference something, and if it just starts going from there, we'll turn it on. Okay. Any comments or reactions? Yes?
I have a question. In the oikonomia model, is there a place for property? I mean, what is the concept of property in that model?
It's a severe critique of private property, but it is not a critique of property in general. We have to look at how the disciples lived as well I believe, Acts or Romans, I can't remember, I think it was Acts. There's this wonderful image is that, you know, the disciples lived and ate and supported together, and there was no one with needs among them. So the sense of caring for each other. In this model on the right, private property is seriously challenged. I believe that it's possible, and so do Daly and Cobb in, now I've lost the title.
For the common good,
thank you. That they suggest that the market economy, rightly understood, might be as about as good as it can get as humans. And that what we need to do is to consciously add goodness back into the equation, because our lives are so integrated with having things that maybe it would be too difficult to reinvent the whole economic model. But the alternative, from Daly and Cobb's point of view, is to ensure that goodness is back in the equation, that whenever we create wealth, we'll create goodness.
So does that imply then that you'd have to have a very progressive tax structure, for example, that earning income per se is not bad, but if you keep it for yourself and don't redistribute it to those who need it, then that's where you start to conflict with descriptions?
That's a very good point. It suggests in a more complex society that government in particular will need to take on sort of heroic leadership at this point, I think, because we'll need to challenge the market economy and challenge, to be quite honest, stockholders who expect a short-term turnaround in profits, typically quarterly, about every 3 months. I'll get to your hand in just a sec, the managing partners of complex corporations know that the investors want to see healthy reports about every 3 months. So it's very short-term monetary exchange of value to the owner that they're concerned about. And only with creative partnerships with government, I think, will CEOs find the courage to ask stockholders to take a different, more long-term view of the creation of wealth that will allow for the creation of goodness. And creative tax incentives and disincentives are a part of that. Yes, Carl.
Well, if what you said was right before, wouldn't that mean that probably a koinonia would probably be looked out upon us because it would not be private property, but all public property? So we'd invite everybody into a home, but it's not your home. it's everybody's home.
That's very close to my understanding. If God were making economic policy, that would be very close to the economic policy that God would want, Carl. Brad?
I want to say, wait a minute. Because I think that private ownership of property is important. The example I would give is my mother and my wife's mother, who've had to move into nursing homes and have to give up much of their private property. They live in a rather impersonal setting in which they have a very small space. Many of the things that are dear to them, they've had to give away or sell. And so that there is personal meaning in objects that have perhaps been used in the family for a long time, and taking them away or saying that they don't matter, or that anyone could come in and use them or have the house or whatever, that doesn't seem to enhance human life to me.
I saw a TV program years ago when I was watching TV, which I'm not doing much now, about a public hospital in Baltimore where the doctors and nurses went out into the poor community around there to support the old people so they could stay in their homes. I think we need new models of what goes on in this country. When I hear something like that, I know we need other models.
Mm-hmm. That's not realistic at all.
Well, it is too.
Oh, come on.
We just have to...
Let me give you an example. My father...
In particular, tell me what is not realistic.
My father moved to Billings, Montana, away from my sister and I. He had a stroke. He was a rather large man. His stroke was so severe that he couldn't take care of it. He ended up in a nursing home. His property paid for his nursing home care. Most of the people that end up in nursing homes aren't these healthy, strong people. They're people that need special care. And I need to say something about the owning property. And Carl, you said it beautifully. It's communism. Communism doesn't work. And if you think it works, you go ask anybody that lives in Eastern Europe or Russia right now, and they'll tell you that it does not work. It's not a realistic economic system.
For small communities, perhaps, but for a nation-sized state, we're just not the instruments that God would like, but it just hasn't proved adequate to incentivize people.
Owner of this company, the stockholder, in a way, be part of that household?
Well, that's you're really getting, as far as I'm concerned, close to the point. I think it's important to note that the people of Israel did live this way. Okay. It's also important to note when they moved into the land of milk and honey that it broke down. Okay. When they were in the wilderness, equally struggling, it appears there was an easier concept to maintain. Now, I'm sort of the opinion is that we are treasure in earthen vessels, and which means that we're all a little bit like cracked pots, and that gives the notion of cracked pot a different image. But maybe the most we can hope for is to try to redeem the market economy. I happen to believe that self-interest has a great deal to do with the human spirit. And it's apparently how God made us, because I don't think that it's evil. I just think that it's part of our makeup. So an economic model strikes me that's going to be creative and life-producing will live in the tension between self-interest and love for the neighbor. And we live in a market economy that I think is overboard in terms of self-interest. So the challenge for this evening is how do we get goodness back in the equation? How do we recognize the tension here? And you have to answer this for your own sake, your own selves, that my belief is that God, if God were an economist making economic policy, that God would create, I agree with Carl, I believe that God would create something far closer to a koinonia. But we are God's people, and we have an opportunity to co-create this with God. So let's just live in the tension a little bit. And what I'd like to do is do something very radical, and that is to critique the system, to put on our prophetic hats and critique the system and to say, how could we make this better? How could we make this something that God would more likely smile upon? In the back. Two of you, how about left and then right?
Adam Smith wrote another book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments.
Uh-huh.
To some, that's actually a more important book than The Wealth of Nations, but in that book, he talks about the importance to the functioning of the market of morality.
You bet.
And that he did not believe the market system would work in the absence of good people and a social consensus on morality.
Yep.
I think a market system could work more like the description on the right column if we, in our transactions, reflected different values. The economy, the market economy, is really a reflection of us and the choices we make and the values we have. One of the problems with the current model is that so much of the value making in our society is through advertising and through media.
Yep.
That is solely controlled by a certain value system, which is more like the crematistic value system and not the oikonomic value system. If a good start towards moving towards this other system would be more egalitarianism and diversity in access to the message-making media.
That's
that
a great
permeates
point.
Our society.
That's a great
because
point.
Because right now, all of the advertising on TV and in the newspapers, it's all the for-profit sector.
And it's about consumption.
It's all about consumption and self-interest.
Yep.
But how much advertising do we get that says, don't smoke in a public place? Or go and get training before you go out and use a handgun. Things that help us be responsible.
Thank you very much.
You know, and so that's what I would urge as a society where the media is not solely in the hands of the crematistic value system so that we can begin to talk to one another through our media with different values. And maybe that'll get reflected in our transactions and in the market economy.
Thank you very much. In the back.
I think that what you're saying about the tension between private property and a more idealistic community, I think the issue of elderly people and what to do with failing health points out in a very concrete example of where our values have not taken root in the community as much as property. And, you know, I'm realistic. I know that we just live in a community where families don't live together and we're spread out and there's a lot of transition. But when I critique where we are and think of a new vision based more on the oikonomia, I think about a community where you don't necessarily have blood relations living with older people, but you have young people and older people living together, and then people aren't forced to give up all their private possessions. They're able to pool their resources. And I think it's those kinds of examples that we all face because we're all getting older. It's those are the opportunities that we have to do something different.
It seems like the macro model that you're talking about here is more like Sweden, where they have, like I said, when I said progressive tax structure, I meant the, you know, the 78% tax on higher incomes and very broad social welfare net. still a market economy, but a big role for government in this case in providing a lot of social services like we were just talking about.
Tell us about some of the services.
That's, I think, probably closer to the Oikonomia model, but it still didn't have a large role for the church there. So you'd have to do something different to get more spirituality into that, and they ultimately are going more towards the current wave of privatization, too, and getting less of a government role also.
I'll come to you in just a sec, though. You just said something I'd like to emphasize a little bit, that if we approach this decision as only participants in a democracy, I think we'll ask certain questions and answer those questions in a particular way. If we approach this as simply participants, as democratic citizens, we'll ask certain questions and answer them in a certain way. If we approach this question as people of faith, and consider our role as stewards, responsible for the household in the owner's absence, I wonder if we would ask different questions, and I wonder if we would answer them in different ways. Bill?
I think we can see the problems with taking either extreme as far as ownership is concerned if we look at air, water, and land. When air and water were considered to be community property, free goods, externalities to the market system, anybody take as much as they can get, dump in at anything they wanted, then the consequences of that became too severe for the community to allow, and the regulations began to come in to protect health and welfare. With land, we've taken primarily the point of view in this country that land is real property. The ownership does rest, other than particular public lands, but primarily private ownership. And yet what the private owner does on one piece of land can greatly affect the neighbor's well-being. Cut down the trees to the property line and the neighbor's trees start to blow down because they're no longer protected. Deforestation on a large scale leading to deserts being formed, erosion and all sorts of things affecting even on a regional or global scale. So I don't think we can take either extreme. We've tried them both and neither one works.
One of the things I'm of the opinion, I could be wrong, that we've not tried is asserting our spiritual responsibilities as stewards into the equation more fully.
Right here.
I think that there is a definite fascination that we have with private property that we all enjoy from the time we are very young, being able to have things.
Sure.
I wonder about...
He's welcome to stay. He's not...
Paul, his brother's outside playing all night.
Okay.
One of the things that I was impressed with recently when I was being told about a different way to run a corporation by a Christian who runs a very large energy producing company was that it was very important to distinguish between human beings and other kinds of property.
Thank you.
And it seems maybe that, just a comment, that in our culture our fascination with private property has perhaps led to an allowance that people be treated as property in a manner which is not consistent with certain biblical principles.
Thank you. I'd like to sort of make one point based on that, if I could. How many folks were here when we talked about the four levels of happiness? Can I see some hands? Good. So some of you will, this will make some sense. But you remember the third level of happiness? Where does H3, what is the source of happiness at H3? Somebody said it.
Relationships.
Others. Could it be that we're people for others? And happiness level 4 is a lived, deep relationship with with the divine. Well, here's an important historical note. I want, as I share this with you, please keep in mind the different levels of happiness, okay? This quote, this story involves Thomas Jefferson, so just a quick backdrop on him. When John F. Kennedy was president and he had gathered, somewhere around
a dozen Nobel Prize-winning scientists, poets, philosophers, and gathered them together in one of those wonderful rooms in the White House. And he opened up the evening, which was going to be a dinner and some time with the president. He opened up the evening something like this. He said, "Never in the history of the United States have so many powerful minds been gathered in this room other than when Thomas Jefferson dined here alone." John Locke, in his reflections about democracy, suggested it should be built on three pillars: life, liberty, and the life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. It's true. It's true. Okay, it's a Lockean understanding of the world. Thomas Jefferson changed that to what?
Happiness.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I wonder what that was going on in his head when he made that change. For us today, what I'd like to suggest is that if we began to pursue happiness in a deeply spiritual way, lives committed to others, lives committed to God, my sense is that this would take care of itself. Let's open it up for, yes, Dale.
There are some examples, you know, you helped us all see that it's great to have any thoughts, but where do we go with some of this?
And great.
There are some Lutheran examples. The National Lutheran Home offers a kind of, I guess
can you all hear Dale up there?
No.
Dale, just a little louder.
The National Lutheran Home outside of Washington, D.C., and there are probably others of these sprouting up around the country where you basically sign in when you're able-bodied into a private residence, but it's part of a community with a continuum of care, sort of like leisure world, except with a Lutheran orientation and a kind of compassionate care that allows for independence and worship and service. And those are, you know, I guess it houses 400, 500 people. There's a nursing home component as part of it as well. It's not an ideal model in that it's some distance from the city center, and it doesn't have an awful lot of folks who actually work there, work somewhere else. So it's pretty much a retirement community. But I mean, that's at least one example of how the church is kind of bridging this gap of public-private community. And in our area, I'm sure this is not the only place where it's happening. Co-housing is becoming a market-driven alternative where folks
tell us what co-housing is.
Well, I guess there's a variety of versions of it. If you were going to do a continuum, a condo with shared property, shared responsibilities for common grounds and pools and rec halls and that sort of thing is one alternative that is mostly individual property. You just kind of live in your own little unit.
Sort of like here at Holden, where you have a place where you sleep, but there's a place where we gather as community to worship, to eat together.
Right. And you know, I think everyone's familiar with that as an alternative. But the other end of co-housing is, and there's a 60-unit development being constructed now outside of, again, our community in Washington, which is kind of high-end. I mean, it's designed to look like a lot like Holden. That's a couple hundred acres. There are individual living units that are attached. Though there's a small kitchen, there is community food preparation. I mean, there's like a big dining hall, a big buddy. So you can sort of split the difference between living alone in a cul-de-sac land and sharing a community setting at the mall, and choosing to live that alternative of probably pureform crematistically. Or one of these alternative ways, again, that seem to be, there's no federal funding involved in this kind of high-end co-housing development, and it it has intentionally a range of income and price of units associated with it.
Supportable in the market economy.
And it's people are buying it. And in fact, there's plans to build yet another.
Okay. Are families invited to buy into this, or is it just for single people without children?
Actually, it's mostly families, although singles are welcome, and a number of the units have been designed for single person occupants.
Is it like that in St. Louis Park, where?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Connie, and then Bill, and then I want to this gentleman here. If you had your hand up for a wild time issue? Okay, let's go. Connie, Bill, and your name, please.
Oh.
Okay. And then I'd like to open it up for the question. What is one thing we can do about this?
Another model of co-housing is a group of people that gets together and decides to do this. And the one that I'm most familiar with is a group of people of very diverse ages, which I think is a good idea, including parents, young parents with young children, all the way up to people older than we are, if you can imagine that. And they just, in the case of this group, they are going to make a lot of decisions by consensus, which you gotta be together a long time before you know whether you're going to get along with these people. And then you buy land and then you develop it. So that's a very human way to begin this kind of thing.
Bill?
Yeah, what I was going to say is very similar to that. There's at least a couple families that I know of in Shoreline where they've recently immigrated. They all have low-paying jobs. They've gotten together with friends or family and bought a home. A home maybe not on in the best place, a busy street or whatever, but a nice, big, beautiful home. And they've been able to buy that house and have three families move into it. And it's got an awful lot of advantages, because they would never be able to buy a home on their own.
Okay. Is it Hale that you say?
Hale. I guess the thing that I want to share would be that I think sinfulness is a part of the equation that really needs to be kept in mind in terms of whatever systems or ideas that we have in mind. And that I think that that's always there, and it's certainly part of our theology. I guess the other thing is that whether or not it is successful or not successful, the idea of management as something that God has given unto us is a call that we all have individually, if we can put it together, you know, as a group, whatever. But that's a call that we all have. Whether we succeed or fail is really many times not left up to us anyway. You don't really know. But I think it's something that all of us have a sense as we read the scriptures that this is something we're called to. And so I just hope that at least, you know, we don't deny that call. We don't deny that opportunity that we have to share with our brothers and sisters and do these things, because we will have missed much in life according to Jesus.
Thanks. I'm going to try to stick with this, only because I would really like to challenge us to do something a little bit different. So I'd like us to be thinking about what is something that we'll do. I've shared in a couple settings that I think morality is sometimes about reasoning and thinking and choosing, but ultimately it's about action. So I'd like to invite us into some moral action. So if political and economic events are spiritual affairs, and re-emphasizing what Duane focused on this morning, Micah 6:8, if our ethical and covenantal responsibilities to God require us to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly, what is something you can do? And I'd like to just build on Holland's point that when asked how does she continue to do her work, Mother Teresa answers that she is more concerned about faithfulness than effectiveness. So what is the faithful thing on your heart that you feel like you can do? And I wouldn't worry about big, but something that if you give voice to it, that you really will try to do it.
And here's what how I'd like to suggest it, is to take a moment of silence and to consider what's on your heart, and then to share it with a neighbor, and then let's hear from as many of you as we'd like before 7:20, something you're going, as soon as you're ready, feel free to talk to a neighbor about what you're thinking about.
On those lines, I have friends who are very much more on the edge financially than I am. Uh-huh. And I'm not sure specifically how to help them, but I know that I can support more, perhaps by offering money sometime, offering our home sometime. I think there's some other ways to support that I haven't discovered yet, but I think that's important.
Okay. Anyone else? Yes, I'm sorry.
Just simply inviting people more frequently into my home to share meals.
Great.
Just to reach out.
Expanding your household, huh?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. I think we have to carry some of this to a higher level organizationally or politically. I have a pet project which I'm going to work on more. Which is, the fact is that in this country, in the healthcare system, the providers of healthcare charge more to people who don't have insurance than to people who do. And this is not one of the items that comes up generally in discussions of this problem. But the fact is that the entire system now operates on the basis of negotiated rates with large groups. And individuals without insurance, or individuals who pay huge amounts for a private policy, have no negotiating leverage. And the hospitals, the doctors, the labs simply charge more, big, big amounts, 20%, 50% more to someone who comes in with no insurance. I think it's a tremendous moral issue which is overlooked by practically everyone. And I think it's an issue which individuals can do something about by contacting the people who run the hospitals and the doctors and the laboratories. The insurance companies aren't going to change. But those individuals that provide the services and charge more to the guy who walks in and has to pay it all out of his own pocket than the guy whose employer pays it all. We as individuals can do something there. If enough people would get to that level, it would affect a very large number of people who are suffering seriously.
Let me applaud what Steve is suggesting, because he's suggesting a strategy. All of our individual efforts are great, and I really do believe that that's where the spirit begins to work in those quiet corners of our life, but also I believe that the Spirit calls us to the public square, and if one person went to a hospital or to a physician and made that point, it would have a certain impact. But an entire church or collection of churches, having considered a document like this, were to identify one issue that you would like to work on in the next year and to do it collectively, I mean, you could change the course of a mighty river by working collectively and pulling ourselves together as, again, the community of God as stewards in sort of a collective understanding of stewardship. Roxy, and then here.
Our insurance commissioner, Deborah Sand, in the state of Washington, is in a roiling battle with the insurance companies over just like these issues, just like he said. And so I vote Deborah Sand, and I tell other people to vote for Deborah Sand. She's great. She saved us all a lot of money.
Let's. I have to relearn your name. I'm sorry.
Diane.
Let's have Diane's comment, and then it's probably time to think about heading towards Vespers.
I guess just thinking about the idea of what we corporately could do. I don't know if everybody is aware of this or not, but in a large number of states in the United States, the ELCA has paid lobbyists.
Thank you.
Whose job it is to work with elected officials to promote socially just laws. We in the state of Washington have one. We also have an office in Washington, D.C. And there are other groups such as Good for the World who do advocacy for particularly for hungry people or people who are living in poverty. And finding out either what your state public policy person is doing or what the National Lutheran Office of Intergovernmental Affairs is doing or what Good for the World is doing, or you know, there actually are some other advocacy groups out there as well. And really assisting in that, I think, can lend some real strength to voices. And also maybe giving input to those people. You know, I mean, if you see this health care coverage as a real issue, I know in the state of Washington, we have basic health care, which is to serve people who kind of fall through the net, who don't have access to health care through their jobs. And one of the things that the churches, the Washington Association of Churches, the Catholics, and the Lutherans all have lobbyists. And one of the things that they worked on last year, not very successfully, but probably would have been more successful had they had more input from constituents, is to try and get better funding for basic health care. So I really suggest connecting with those.
This may sting a little bit, but I would like to end with this concept, is that passivity, I believe, does equal compliance. And only action. When we know that something needs fixing, only action is more. Okay? Bless you in the spirit as we go out and try to do something for the common good. Thanks a lot.